Israel has announced doubling settlements in the occupied Golan Heights. This comes despite the fact that the move is deemed illegal by the international community. Why then would Israel decide on this? And why at this time? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the significance of such a move, the silence by the U.S., which some take as an approval of Israel's move, and whether this could spark a conflict between Israel and its enemies.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden, which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Busnish, who joins us from Belgrade. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, gentlemen, welcome to this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Lazard, I will start with you. For people who are not familiar with the Golan or the Golan Heights, which have been referred to as the occupied Golan Heights. Why don't you give us a history check as to where the controversy is here, or misunderstanding?
Well, Israel took control of the Golan Heights in the after the 1973 war, and has moved decisively to Israelize them, to fill them with settlers and other kind of forms of development. And the world, while formally stating its disapproval, since the developments are in clear violation of international law, has done absolutely nothing to stop them. Now, Israel's strength in the region has only grown since then, and U.S. backing has grown ever more unqualified. So therefore, Israel now feels emboldened to double the population, its settler population in the Golan, and to further solidify its hold over the conquered region.
Well, let me ask you your reaction on this, if I may, John Busnich. Let me bring that up as to what Naftali Bennett has said. This is our moment. This is the moment of the Golan Heights, when he announced and said Israel intends to double the number of illegal settlements in the occupied Golan Heights. What do you think that Israel has taken the decision to do this now, to make this announcement of this depth of settlements coming at the Golan Heights?
Well, considering that this is coming in the first year of U.S. President Biden's term of office, one can presume that every move that's being made by Israel has been previously approved and checked in Washington. So I guess that what we're seeing here is the payback for the investment that Israel makes in the U.S. elections. And just to let your audience know here, the United States government is called the best government that money can buy, and not for no reason. In the U.S. elections, the financing for the candidates for president in particular, because that's the executive office and deals with these kinds of international issues, the financing for the two candidates is very, very heavily skewed in favor of Jewish Americans and pro-Israeli, pro-Zionists. There are born-again Christians in the United States that consider the state of Israel essential to the United States. And so what we've got here is a quid pro quo. The government of the United States is largely selected by Israeli financiers because it's impossible to get elected in the United States without hundreds of millions of dollars. And once those office holders take office, they are required to pay back the people who paid for their election. And that's what we're seeing now. And that's why Mr. Bennett is referring to this as the special hour for the Golan Heights. It does not change the fact that the Golan Heights are a legal part of Syria, that the United Nations has declared this, and that is international law.
Well, I'm trying to understand, Daniel Azar, what international law means when, as you mentioned, Tel Aviv unilaterally annexed the Golan Heights back in the year 1981. So here we are, it's the year 2021. Well, almost over now. It's going to be the year 2022. So whatever decades that is, what happened?
You're absolutely right. I mean the term international law covers a multitude of sins. And essentially, the bottom line seems to be that the U.S. and its allies have every power, every ability to do what they wish. And they call it legal because in today's world, might makes right. So you're right. This is contrary to international law, but the United States chooses to disregard international law whenever it wishes, and so therefore the phrase is becoming increasingly meaningless. So I totally agree. By the way, I wouldn't want to exaggerate the impact of Jewish voters in the United States. American Jews are less than 2% of the population at this point. What's happened is that across the board, across the entire foreign policy establishment in Washington, Israel is now determined to be of prime importance in terms of U.S. imperial interests. And virtually all factions agree on the importance of maintaining that U.S.-Israeli alliance.
Well, since you're saying that, and since you have also said that, John Bosnich, again, I don't want to veer off the topic here, but we know that there has been somewhat of a development when it comes to AIPAC in terms of the way that they're going to, be part of the U.S. decision-making when it comes to, let's say, the midterms. From what I understand, this was a development that came just recently. So are we talking about more influence by Israeli lobby when it comes to decision-making, such as what we have noticed on the Golan Heights? And what is the U.S. stance? We know what Trump catapulted this into recognition. Does Biden hold the same view, even though Bennett said he does?
Well, I take note of your other guest's comments. Mr. Lazar is right. Jewish voters in the United States are only 2 or maybe 3% of the voters. I'm not talking about votes here. I'm talking about money. John Mearsheimer produced a book called The Israel Lobby when I was working as a lobbyist in Washington. And what he turned up in the statistics for the donations to the two parties was that although Jewish Americans only make up 2 to 3% of the voters in the United States, the donations to the Democratic Party, 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party come from Jewish Americans, and 40% of the donations to the Republican Party come from Jewish Americans. So it's not the votes that we're counting here, it's the dollars that we're counting here. And that's why we can say that the U.S. government's policies are being skewed by exorbitant power of the Israel lobby. Now, to get back to the subject at hand, the idea that Israel can proceed by doubling the number of Israelis in the Golan Heights, the current population of the Golan Heights is roughly 50-50 Arab and Israeli. If the Israelis seek to double their population, that would give them two-thirds population in the Golan Heights, and they might attempt to make a referendum there and pass it by two-thirds sometime in the future. That policy is illegal. It does not change the fact. And I'm very sorry to make this parallel, but Adolf Hitler seized the Sudetenland from Czech Republic, from Czechoslovakia, right before World War II by stating that the majority there were ethnic Germans. That is a terrible precedent for Israel, a country founded as a result of the Holocaust, to follow. Uh-huh. That is what we're dealing with here. Mr. Bennett is following policies that resemble those followed by Adolf Hitler before World War II.
Okay. We're looking at a reaction, Daniel Lazar, coming from Syria, naturally. And what I'm looking at over here in terms of the reaction of the foreign ministry, condemning the plans to double the number of the settlers, the Golan, within 5 years as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation. So what is Syria thinking right now? It's seeing this happen. It's being bombed practically every other week. What is Israel's plans? Because we're looking at the military side, bombing of Syria, and now this. What are Israel's plans when it comes to then Syria in turn? Is this a natural progression we're looking at here?
Yeah, I think we are, actually. I think that's a good way of describing it. It's a natural progression. I mean, look, Israel has devoted itself to the destruction of the entire northern sphere of states, of Syria first and foremost, but also Iraq and Iran as well. I mean, I think the figures are that Israel has conducted more than 100 bombing sorties over Syria in recent years. It is determined to spread chaos in this country. It was a big supporter of the U.S.-Saudi war on Syria, which reduced that state to near rubble, visited incredible destruction on the Syrian people. One of the really great crimes of the 21st century. And that's continuing. So on one hand, Israel wages relentless war on Syria, and on the other, it seeks to strengthen its hand in the Golan Heights, which it took from Syria in 1973. So So it's a it's kind of like a two-pronged strategy: destroy your enemy and strengthen your own base. And Syria, Syria has had its hands full. I mean, it's fought a desperate action against the U.S. Saudi-led campaign of destruction. It's managed to hold itself together, even though the eastern half of the country is still occupied by the U.S. And there's little Syria can do except to try to to sustain itself under this withering punishment launched by both Israel and America. So Syria, it's amazing that Syria has survived and
sure.
as well as it has. But that punishment is not going to go away soon.
Mm-hmm. John Busnich, I can't help but listening to Daniel Lazar explain what Israel is doing to just skim over something that is a violation of international law, the bombing of Syria, and when I said it's a natural progression as to the Israel moving towards Syria, that's just, it's not a huge deal. But I'm guessing, and I'm almost sure that it is. And,
and
we're looking here at my question to you, at a reaction that has to come. Are we looking at a spark here that will then entail a reaction? And my question to you is, from whom and how? Because at this point, Syria is being bombed. The Golan Heights is being having settlement construction happen there, probably sooner than later. What are we going to see coming?
Well, as you know, I've worked as a political advisor on three continents, and I'm sorry to have to admit that one of the standard policies of every kind of political activity is to make a step too far and see if you can hold it. And that is what is happening in this case. Israel is attempting to make a step into absolutely illegal action, an act of aggression, as you rightly mentioned and as your other guest underlined. It's an act of aggression. And the policy, it seems, on the part of Mr. Bennett, as the Israeli leader, is to see if he can get away with it. Now, if he gets away with it, that just gives the go-ahead for the next step. And the next step could take any number of forms. So now it's a question for whether the United Nations would take any action. That's number one. Of course, the United States would veto such a move. And then if the United States vetoes any action at the UN, then Syria would have to look to supportive powers who have protected it in these recent years. And that obviously points to Russia. And I think that Russia has an unsettled score with American occupation forces in eastern Syria. And we could see an escalation that brings in some form of confrontation between Russia and America on the ground. That's the short-term worst-case scenario. The slightly longer-term worst-case scenario is that Syria attempts some kind of military action against Israel, which I don't think Syria is foolish enough to do at this stage, having just suffered the destruction of so many years of bombing. So I think we're in a bit of a stalemate. But Israel's actions demonstrate one thing in particular: an unwillingness to negotiate and an unwillingness to seek peace. And when you have a side that's unwilling to negotiate and unwilling to seek peace, then you're actually activating a non-standard confrontation. Mm-hmm. That means bombings, that means terrorism, that means whatever alternatives are available to the people who are the target of the aggression.
I'm curious, Daniel Lazar, what Israel's partners, if I may call that, are thinking about this, the ones that signed that so-called normalization deals, like the UAE, or when you talk about Bahrain, that this is this what they thought Israel would do? Did they anticipate something like this happening in terms of Israeli action? And especially, of course, when it comes to things like Palestine, but in particular when it comes to Syria. And we know that the UAE had his foreign minister just recently visit Syria.
Well, unfortunately, the truth is really dreadful. The power balance has never been more lopsided. The U.S. and Syria, U.S. and Israel have never had a freer hand in the Middle East, and states, you know, dictatorial states like the UAE have completely, you know, folded into the U.S. imperial presence. And a state like Bahrain, for example, is a dictatorship at war with its own people, a minority Sunni dictatorship, which is imposes terrorism on its own largely Shiite population. It's completely outrageous, and unfortunately the imbalance has only worsened over the years. So there's no answer in sight. I mean, all we know is that the U.S. weakness is exposed in Afghanistan. Its military leadership and political leadership are both incompetent. Israel is very strong, but it may be in the end less strong than it currently appears. And that the situation in the Middle East as a whole has become so unstable and so explosive that it can't continue much longer. But beyond that, we really can't say anything. For the moment, the balance of power grossly favors the U.S.-Israeli side, and that is likely to continue for the near term, at the very least.
All right, so quick answer from you, since this is the last question. John Bosnich, are we looking at these settlements actually going ahead? Are they going to get executed? Are there going to be Israelis actually living there in this area that's occupied? And what form of reaction are we going to see, if any? And I hate to say just reaction, because there should be action taken to prevent this from happening from the so-called international community.
Well, you're absolutely right. And each time that Israel declares an openly illegal act and proceeds to execute that act, it's one more brick knocked out of the so-called wall of international law. If that wall collapses completely, the only alternative is war. And I'd like to make the point here that there were crusader kingdoms in the Middle East that lasted longer than the State of Israel has lasted so far. And there's a good possibility that if Israel doesn't come to terms and come to some kind of peace with its neighbors and respect their legal borders, that the State of Israel will end up like the non-existent, long-gone crusader states.
Of course, that depends how much money they have to spend inside the U.S. when it comes to the politics there. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, John Bosnich. We appreciate it, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. And also, Daniel Lazar, thank you, journalist and author there from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikove Tahwe, entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allah, Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وقالوا أساطير الأولين اكتتبها فهي تملى
And they say, legends of the former peoples which he has written down, and they are dictated to him morning and afternoon. Say, O Muhammad, it has been revealed by He who knows every secret within the heavens and the earth. Indeed, He is ever forgiving and merciful.
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, we were discussing the fifth verse of this chapter. وَقَالُوا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ اكْتَتَبَهَا فَهِيَ تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَأَصِيلًا And they say, The Holy Quran is the stories of the ancients. He has got them written, so they are dictated before him morning and evening. The sixth verse says, قُلْ أَنزَلَهُ الَّذِي يَعْلَمُ السِّرَّ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ Say, He sent it down, who knows the secrets in the heavens and the earth. إِنَّهُ كَانَ غَفُورًا رَحِيمًا Verily, He is ever forgiving, merciful. So, as you may remember, we said that the unbelievers were trying to say and claim that the Prophet has nothing by himself. He has no knowledge, no innovation, and he is not related to prophethood and revelation. And what he has brought for us as the Holy Quran is some stories and some old legends, and he himself has named it Heavenly Book. And in order to achieve this aim, this prophet, so-called prophet, is helped by the others every day. تُمْلَى عَلَيْهِ بُكْرَةً وَأَصِيلًا These stories are dictated before him morning and evening, and these stories are recited to him morning and evening, and he writes them. That's why, from the other side, we can claim that he is lying when he says he's not educated. No, he's totally lying, and he can write, and he can read, and that's why he has made up these old legends and stories. As a matter of fact, they try to break up people who were with the Prophet ﷺ with these arguments. If he were inspired by the others every day and night, the question is, How would it be possible to remain hidden from others? The verses of the Quran were revealed to him in journeys when he, the Prophet, was among the people, or sometimes in solitude and in all conditions. And additionally, the Holy Quran was a collection of different teachings, religious ordinances, laws, and some parts of the story of the Prophets. When all of the Holy Quran was sent down, It was not like what was in the Old and New Testaments, as well as the Arab superstitious legends. This was completely different from the old legends and even the Testaments. So, if we compare both of them, we see what the truth is. because those scriptures were full of superstitions, but these verses were free from any kind of superstition. So they themselves knew the difference.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Therefore, answering these groundless accusations, the last concerned verse says, قُلْ أَنزَلَهُ الَّذِي يَعْلَمُ السِّرَّ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Say, He sent it down, who knows the secrets in the heavens and the earth. So, it refers to this matter, that the content of the book and its various mysteries that are about sciences, and they are all about the history of former nations, the needs, the laws, and even some secrets of nature and news about the future, these all indicate that it is not the product of man's mind. It is not compiled by the help of such and such persons. It is generated by the one who knows the mysteries of the heavens and the earth, and nothing is out of his knowledge realm. But then, the path of return is open to those who are liar and evil thinkers. And in the end of the verse, it says, إِنَّهُ كَانَ غَفُورًا رَحِيمًا. Verily, He is ever forgiving, merciful. And in agreement with His mercy, He has sent these prophets, He has sent these heavenly books, and in agreement with His forgiveness, He will pardon the countless sins in the light of faith and penance, on condition that the servants are truly returning towards Him. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We are done with the sixth verse, and God willing, we'll move on to the seventh in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. That's 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war, and therefore Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it, its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements. Not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led with our Australian friends. That I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us. And I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put.
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals. I'm not accusing anyone of lying, I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons, and I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments. Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally, a situation that has not been this bad in decades. Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims, with the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood. Perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government, but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Tensions in several areas in northern West Bank have been high in the recent days, particularly in the village of Burqa, northwest Nablus. On Saturday night, over 250 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces in Burqa, one day after thousands of Israeli settlers attacked the village under the protection of Israeli army. The Palestinian Authority held the Israeli regime fully responsible for what it described as expansionist colonial war. The PA also called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its aggression and settlers' violence.
The only side which should be held accountable is the Israeli regime. It's responsible for the increasing violence by the Israeli settlers against the Palestinians. It also bears responsibility for a dangerous escalation likely to happen in the occupied lands.
The Palestinian factions have said the settlers' organized terrorism requires the development of a popular action in various ways. This means forming popular guard and protection committees to defend the Palestinians and repel settlers' attempts to storm Palestinians' villages and towns. Anti-settlement organizations have warned that if the settlers' systematic attacks are not stopped, they will turn into real massacres against Palestinians.
I think if it continue like this, it could lead to disasters, maybe massacres. We don't know, but the way that they are attacking the people, the way that they're attacking the houses, trying to enter inside the villages, to enter houses and beat the people there to the extent of killing, this is, you know, it shows us that this is, has to be stopped and has to be confronted strongly by the Palestinians.
Almost 10 days ago, Israeli army imposed military reinforcements after an Israeli settler was killed in the Israeli settlement of Homish near the village of Burqa. Since then, tensions have been high as Israeli forces installed several makeshift checkpoints around the cities of Jenin and Nablus. Thousands of settlers have visited the site over the past days and terrorized Palestinians. Today, Palestinians in many areas are again facing violence and attacks from both armed settlers and Israeli forces. Different political powers say there's an urgent need for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israel. Palestinians call for an international protection, along with dismantling of old Israeli settlements. Mona Qadir, North Occupied, Ramallah.
Israel is stepping up its acts of violence against Palestinians with impunity. Attacks by settlers have grown more audacious recently. In the latest incident, over 250 Palestinian protesters were injured in an Israeli attack on the village of Burqa near Nablus in the occupied West Bank that happened late Sunday. From live rounds and tear gas to rubber bullets and stun grenades, the Israeli forces fired everything they could to ward off the Palestinian protesters. It all started when the Israeli army moved in, deploying soldiers to the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of buses packed with settlers. They also closed off the entrance to the village of Burqa. And that infuriated the Palestinians and triggered protests. In recent days, Burqa has been a flashpoint of clashes. Israeli settlers, with protection from the army, have attempted to raid Palestinian houses there. In a separate accident that happened a few days ago, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian woman, killing her near Ramallah in the northern West Bank. It came just hours after settlers attacked a nearby village that rapidly escalated into a round of violence, with Israeli troops firing rubber bullets and tear gas and injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian activist Paul Lorodi believes that Tel Aviv is seeking a policy of isolating Palestinians and forcing them out of their homes.
But the strategy of the Israelis has been to surround large cities like Nablus, as they did in Qadhiliyah, and to isolate them and to destroy their economy and basically to force Palestinians to find work elsewhere.
The atrocities go on, but the international community remains silent. That has raised criticisms that the lack of global reaction to the situation in fact gives the green light to the Israeli regime to continue with its unjust policies. Even the UN has lashed out at the world community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of the Israeli crimes. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, says the international community must hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He says Tel Aviv is refusing to comply with the UN resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Anti-war activist Ken Stone believes a concerted international effort is needed to tackle the situation.
Behind the colonial project in Palestine is the might of the U.S. empire. And the U.S. and its allies, including, unfortunately, Canada, enable this kind of mistreatment of the Palestinians.
Palestinians are witnessing bolder and more violent attacks with each passing day, and they are waiting to see when the international community will finally move to stop the injustice.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit. But the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and backstance and the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the North of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the North of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do, protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, it's doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
The UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that. The two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement with the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. The UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish Unionists or Irish Nationalists, of course, the Tories have always used unionists for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and of course, the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving her country's differences with the EU, what nearly 2 years of negotiations by her predecessor failed to do.
The UK blames the EU for being inflexible and worrying too much about the so-called integrity of their single market. And Brussels blames London for trying to scrap an international treaty that it signed nearly 2 years ago. Experts say there's no obvious way out of the ongoing stalemate, meaning that Brexit is not exactly done yet. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Telecom is a major ICT exhibition in Iran that brings together both private and state actors in information and communication technology to showcase their products and services. After a limited edition last year due to the coronavirus pandemic, the annual event has this year opened its doors to all domestic companies to participate.
Our company produces smart systems that work based on the Internet of Things, and recently we produced a smart assistant for animal farming, which helps the farmer monitor the health of livestock and their latest needs.
In the past 2 years, due to the coronavirus pandemic and the growing trend toward remote learning, we thought it would be a good idea to produce tablets for students to easily follow up on their online education. We are also active in producing apps for a range of uses with a focus on telemedicine.
When it comes to ICT, any advancement affects all other industries. The emergence of the 5G network, for example, was a game changer for surgical operations, allowing telesurgeries to be conducted seamlessly and with higher precision. Like this newly unveiled Iranian-made robotic surgeon called Sina, which uses 5G to allow a remote surgery to be carried out.
Sina's surgery system has two main subsystems: a master robotic console at the surgeon's side and a slave robotic system at patient's side, which are connected through a 5G wireless network. So any movement of my hands here are transferred to the slave robotic arms, and it is as if the surgeon is present beside the patient.
For sanctions hit Iran, it's not an easy task to catch up with modern trends in the ICT. However, the government says it has tripled its allocated budget for the ICT this year to encourage local firms to push the industry forward and promote what it refers to as digital economy.
The increase in the allocated budget is a result of the government's special attention to the ICT sector. We are planning to promote electronic government and move away from traditional market toward online market. All this needs a strong infrastructure which the government needs to build.
The government says it is also trying to capitalize on venture capital funds and accelerators to move the ICT sector forward. In recent years, an increasing number of sponsoring firms have turned to this area to support innovative ideas and lead them to the market, the results of which remain to be seen in the years to come.
The ICT sector in Iran is among the hardest hit by U.S. sanctions, but the country says it views any challenge as an opportunity. Officials say this expo gives a small picture of how Iran's ICT has thrived under pressure and tried to keep abreast of the fast-growing trend in the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Haridwar from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.